Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here and...
Gabe.
He's back.
I'm back, buddy.
He's back. So yeah, I've kind of dangled your absence in the air for a couple weeks here to our listeners around the world. Gabe?
Yeah.
Where were you?
I had a surgery on my shoulder. And my rotator cuff was torn a little bit and my shoulder was full of arthritis.
Full of arthritis.
So a year ago, I had a hockey injury. I got checked in the boards by this dude, Lutz. Anyways, a year ago, and then that's when that little tear in the rotator cuff happened. And it wasn't a big injury back then. It didn't even hurt that bad. It felt a little weird on the next morning.
Yeah.
Fast forward a year, and my entire shoulder was infected or inflamed, I guess is the correct term. And I needed a surgery because the pain was so bad I couldn't even sleep.
You were having a tough time putting on your jacket at that point.
At this point, I couldn't really do anything. I got a couple of cortisone shots. They didn't do anything. I was given prednisone, which is a cortisone in a pill form, a corticosteroid that makes the pain, the inflammation go away. That worked for a little bit. But yeah, I had to have the surgery, had it done 3 weeks ago. And already now I'm better off when it comes to my shoulder than I was before the operation.
And not only that, you're on the up and up,
yeah.
Right?
It's going to keep getting better and better. I'm going to physical therapy 2-3 times a week. The first week was really, really bad. The pain after the surgery I couldn't sleep for a week. And that I've got an ulcer and I can't take pain meds. It was just a mess. But now I'm fine, Connor. I'm happy to be back.
I'm happy to have you back, yeah. Gabe. One thing you missed during those weeks.
Yeah.
Were many, many emails coming in. You and I weren't communicating all that much during your absence because I think we communicate so much every single week that we like to enjoy our absences.
It was a nice break.
Radio silence, yeah. So, I'll update you on some of the emails, and I'll start with the loveliest.
Okay.
It says, "Hi, Connor and Gabe, / Gabe and Connor, parentheses, you're both loved equally." "I've been meaning to write this for a long time. I discovered Science Unscripted about a year and a half ago and have been a fan ever since. Your podcast is just what the doctor ordered. Your voices are soothing and the lack of melodrama is deeply appreciated. Even better, I love that Christine is her name. I love that she loves this. I love that you don't use cheap production tricks and loud noises to make me listen. Rather, you calmly and or playfully present the information in such a way that I'm not diving for the nearest deep, dark cave just to avoid the cacophony." Mm. By the way, Christina, part of the reason we love that you've noted that and appreciated it is that's a conscious decision we make and made years ago.
Yeah, no jingles or the use of bells and whistles, as they're called, to get people's attention or to make things sound more important than they might be.
If we have relevant audio, like in our last episode, the researcher conducted all her research on an island in Panama and had recorded things there, we will happily incorporate that in there. But in general, we try to just have facts. It's a long email, and she goes on to say how much she appreciated it. She went on a deep dive through episode after episode after episode.
What?
And didn't want to listen to one episode. Waited.
Uh-oh.
Toxic masculinity. And how much she appreciated the way we went about it. She loved it, actually.
She was afraid that we were going to botch it.
The topic is just awful. Yeah, and what if, I don't know. Yeah. What if we did it terribly? What if we were actually toxic? What if we had agreed with him? I don't know if she was scared of that.
Yeah.
And she writes, "Anyway, eventually I had the strength to listen to the episode, and wow, I was so proud of you, first for tackling the topic, and second for standing up to this guy without using cheap tactics, malice, or aggression. You two are what good men, good brothers, good friends, good husbands, good dads, good scientists, good damn humans look like. I'm so grateful for you." Mm. And the final line is that our laughter is infectious and a welcome cure for the misanthropic heart. Thank you, Christina.
And this guy that she was referring to is Sterling Cooper, the toxic masculinity influencer that we spoke to at length.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Christina.
Yeah. So a quick couple emails here.
Please.
One is from a longtime listener. Brent is his name. And this was about our discussion on whether you should eat for two during pregnancy.
Oh.
And he writes...
With Eunice,
yeah. And how many extra calories should you be having during a pregnancy?
Yeah.
And one of the things he said is far be it for me as a guy to give women a tip on their pregnancy. But he ends up mentioning a book called The Expectant Father by Armin Brot, kind of a German sounding name, and that there's a power shake recipe in there, like a milkshake or a power shake that he ended up making for his...
I'm listening.
Yeah, his wife.
Is he going to give us the ingredients here? Or what?
He gave me a link. I didn't follow the link up.
Oh, okay.
But effectively, what he was trying to say is that there are two benefits to rolling up your sleeves in the kitchen when your wife is pregnant or when your partner is pregnant. Your wife will love it, and it will make you feel useful at a time when you are mostly not.
On the sideline, yeah.
Yeah, and so I thought that was a nice tip to share. Again, it's called The Expectant Father. It's a book I've never read, but comes suggested here. Another email from Shirley. Shirley writes, and this is in reference to our episode on balding. Gabe is not going to go bald. I am going to go bald. What should you do? You should probably accept that fact and move on with it. But it's a personal choice whether you,
there you go, yeah,
go for medications to try to keep your hair, if you go for a hair transplant. But she goes on to say here, actually, it's a very short one. Patrick Stewart, Yul Brynner, Sean Connery, Telly Savalas. These are all famous male actors who are bald. Hubba.
Sir Patrick Stewart. Yeah, I can. I'm totally with you on that one.
Need I say more? Love your program.
Yeah.
And finally, in our discussion about chimpanzees and why they just didn't, they're not able to do so much that we can.
Oh, that got broadcast.
Yeah, yeah, nice. That did get broadcast. Yeah, our discussion with Edwin van Leuven in Utrecht in the Netherlands. He goes to Zambia regularly.
What a guy.
Really fascinating study on chimpanzees. It's worth listening to. And we had a listener email that I then forwarded to the researcher, and he answered it. So the question from our listener was, I would like to know if there are any other animals out there that keep pets.
Oh, what a great question.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd never had that question. So I forwarded that to Ed. And he emailed me back and he said, yes, certain ant species keep aphids as pets.
What are aphids? And can you put a leash around their their neck? Do they have necks?
So I had to look this up, and I'm just going to quote directly from Wikipedia. Aphids are small sap-sucking insects and members of, the superfamily. Common names include green fly and black fly. They're very small. You see them climbing around on like stems of bushes.
Or what? Following ants around or riding ant back?
Going to their dog bowl, but it's the aphid bowl of food.
Aphid bowl.
So what happens here is they protect the aphids from predators, and in return, they quote-unquote milk the aphids for honeydew, a sugary substance the aphids excrete. But I don't know such examples for any other species, so I'll kind of leave that question open for our listeners out there, some of whom may know of other animals that do keep pets that we're just not aware of. Great question. Great answer.
I got a great feeling that one of our listeners is going to know this one.
Yeah.
They're going to have some kind of weird information from somewhere, probably Canada.
About animal pets. Okay, so we've got science.
I got a couple, yeah. Where should you look when you're engaged in a video call?
Oh, a video call.
Yeah, let's say you're doing a job interview. This is a very specific one. Where do you look?
Okay, I think I don't know what this study is about, but what I think happens is people look at their monitor and they look into the eyes of the person on the monitor. Yeah. And what you should be doing is something that I think is so unnatural. I hate doing it myself.
Yeah.
It's you should look directly into the webcam camera.
So this is the question about eye contact, right? Do you make contact with the eyes of the person you're looking at on the screen? Or do you look at that camera because by doing that, they are getting your eyes?
Yeah, so it should be the camera.
And there is a very clear answer to this. This was a study out of Hiroshima. Absolutely look at the camera.
Stare into it.
Stare into the camera. The more eye contact you make, or the more you give the person you're speaking to the feeling that you are looking into their eyes, the better you will do on a job interview. So they had 12 people, 6 male, 6 female, do a mock job interview. One of the recordings, they were looking at the eyes, i.e. their eyes were below or skewed going down.
Yeah.
The next one, they were looking at that camera, so they were making eye contact. And the third one was just an audio only. 38 people listened or watched these recordings. there was a significant difference. You were evaluated way better if you were looking into the camera.
Interesting, yeah.
In terms of intimacy, social desirability, and of course the most important one, hireability. You did twice as well, saying the same thing, just looking into the camera.
I find that really interesting because it upends something that I thought would have happened there, which is just based on my personal experience. Here at DW, I've had to give live camera interviews, and you're looking into something very inhuman when you look at a camera.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I've kind of lost my train of thought. You have to really focus. It's not like talking to a human. It's like talking into outer space. And so I would have thought maybe the quality of the content that they were saying would have dropped because they're not looking at the human. They're not being reminded, I'm actually talking to a human being. But that makes it very clear. It doesn't matter. Look into the camera.
Especially when you are speaking, because it leaves me with the question, when the person is speaking to me and I'm not looking at them, I'm looking at this black dot camera, this piece of plastic, then I can't react. My body language is not going to be the same as if I'm looking at that person speak to me.
Yeah.
Because of course, when we're speaking like us right now, we're physically in the studio. I can look at your eyes while I speak to you, and you look at my eyes. Of course, that's the easiest way to do it. But if you're just looking into a screen, you can't get the best of those both worlds, I guess. But from this study, it is absolutely clear if you want to do well on a job interview or connect with the person that you're speaking to, look into that camera.
That's really useful practical advice, and I hope what I'm about to talk about isn't necessarily as practical, but still interesting to know. If you're going to a university, right? Mm-hmm. That means you're 18 years old. That's what this study was about. I would extrapolate and say, if you're moving into a strange new environment that is somewhat stressful, what can make you happy? And what researchers looked at here in this study is whether selfless acts of kindness toward others, if there's any connection between that and your happiness during that phase.
Right away in that first acute phase.
In this case, it was the first 6 weeks.
Got it.
Students they're all 18 years old. This one, about 200 participants, and it was really heavily skewed female. Mm-hmm. I think 20 of those were guys. Average age 18. And they, every Sunday for 6 weeks, they had to fill out a survey with 50 questions on it. Mm-hmm. And the questions were effectively, did you do things like, and I'm going to pull it up right here, take on extra work to lighten someone's load? That was the most common pro-social act that these students were engaged in. Other things, give up your seat, plan a surprise treat, ask a barista how they're doing. It's kind of a nice thing to do. Buy gifts for another for no reason. That happened a couple times, not too often. And then the one that never happened, and this surprised me, this study was out of Vancouver, BC. Mm. Not one of the 200 people over the course of 6 weeks picked up garbage.
Because it's so clean in Vancouver?
I don't think so. I don't know. That's what I'm left wondering. Is it so clean that you don't need to? Or are these students, maybe it's the campus, maybe the campus is exceptionally clean, maybe they have really good cleaning services,
they're so spoiled that they just never had.
Effectively what they discovered, this is no surprise, but if you're engaging in more pro-social activities, you're happier.
Wow.
You have...
And they had them fill out a survey.
That was part of the survey every 6 weeks. Your well-being goes up. Again, this is association. This is not causation. They're not saying if you're sad and stressed out in a new city, go hold the door open for somebody because that's going to make you happy. Although I would think personally, if I were kind of reminded to do that once in a while and did it and you get that smile from the person saying, hey, thanks. I do think that gives you a little boost.
Yeah. But there was enough of an association from the 200 people who filled that out that if you do these altruistic things, it will make you feel better.
It means you also feel better. Huh. It's hard to say. They're saying that what they need is an experiment where they force people to do more things.
Got it.
So this is step one. But it's a way of kind of, I think for people out there, you can look at yourself and note that if you've stopped doing those nice things for people, it might mean that you're actually in a bad place. Like it's an indicator. It's a marker. It's like a stock price that would indicate how well is my life going right now. Last thing I'll say, this is my favorite line from the whole study. that one participant did have to be excluded because they reported an unattainable amount of pro-social activity during 1 week. They recorded 1,923 acts, which was 1,817 acts more than the average of all other participants.
Can you divide that by seven? How many acts per day is that?
So either on the streets of Vancouver, BC, we have the next Mother Teresa helping everyone.
Yeah.
And then in that case, it's really unfair that they got excluded from the study. Or we have a very hilarious 18-year-old liar. And I think that maybe is my favorite part of the whole study.
Okay.
Well, takeaway. Yeah, very good takeaway. So pay attention to whether you're being kind to people out there, because if not, it's an indication that your life might be too stressful.
Yeah,
maybe you need to reduce the stress.
Sorry for jumping in on you there. And for the love of God, if you have a job interview online, look at that black hole.
The black hole of death.
Because therefore, it doesn't matter if you're making eye contact. For that person you're speaking to, you are.
Yeah.
And that's more important.
And do you know of any other animals that keep a different animal as a pet? We really are interested in that. I love hearing about that kind of those kind of wacky biology facts. As always, we are su@dw.com. And that was the euphoric sound of the Starship, the SpaceX Starship, doing a splash landing for the very first time in the Indian Ocean and doing it correctly despite this flap almost burning off during reentry. The whole team there, obviously, I mean, I don't think they're told that they have to clap that enthusiastically. I think they are really excited because this is the craft. Together with the super heavy booster that landed in the Gulf of Mexico, this is what is supposed to take SpaceX astronauts and possibly many other astronauts to Mars. That's the one that happened this month. Next test is in another month. These are really, really exciting times to think about human beings going to a different planet for the first time.
Yeah, but I hope... that those astronauts are aware of what we're going to be talking about next, the kidneys.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, everyone. I'm Keith Siu. I'm a renal physiologist at University College London, and I just did a study on whether your kidneys will make it to Mars and back.
Will my kidneys make it to Mars and back, Keith?
That is a big question mark. At the moment, it's looking like there are some... troubled times ahead for whether or not you will come back with full function.
So if I go to Mars and then come right back, would they still work or will they will they fail on the way to Mars and I can't get back, or where are we at?
So it's about a 9-month trip there, and then because of the orbits of Earth and Mars, it's not always going to be the same kind of syncing up of the two planets, so could be another wait on Mars of a year before you come back into orbit again for another 9-month trip back. So you could be looking at a 3-year round trip. So even there and back again, if you're just kind of to circle around and come straight back, it's about 18 months. And our study has shown in a dose of simulated galactic cosmic radiation, this is the kind of exotic space radiation you get exposed to, that we're seeing signs of damage in some of the simulations that we're doing.
Can you explain for me what exactly is happening when I'm out in space, in a spaceship, and radiation is what is flying through my kidneys? What's going on there?
So the radiation that you're getting is coming from all directions throughout the galaxy. It's going to be going and hitting the ship, so the spacecraft that you're in, or astronauts currently in the International Space Station. And those particles, because they're very large, when they collide with the metal of the ship, they're going to cause secondary radiation. So you're going to get gamma rays, you're going to get neutrons coming out. That's going to amplify the radiation.
How exactly does that happen when gamma rays are going and hitting the kidneys? Do they just stop working? They can't filter the blood anymore? Or what exactly goes wrong?
So we haven't looked at the gamma rays, but these particles, the galactic cosmic radiation, they're causing the initial part of the tubules of the kidney called the proximal tubule. This reabsorbs all your sugars, your amino acids, 70% of your calcium, phosphorus, sodium, all these kind of good things you want to keep in your body. When it hits this part, we see damage, something called radiation-induced nephropathy. And when that happens, you kind of start peeing away these things, start wasting them away, and that can lead to failure of your kidneys in the long term. And we see this with patients who get abdominal radiation for cancer therapies, and the kidney's the rate-limiting organ for the amount of dose you can get.
Based on this research, if we put 100 astronauts into a spacecraft, let's say 50 men, 50 women, we send them off to Mars and they come back, how many have permanently damaged kidneys, and how many have complete kidney failure somewhere along the way?
So that's very, very hard to say. I think what's worth pointing out in our study is that we looked at 86 humans, about 400 mice, and about 60 rats that had been up in the space station for anywhere upwards of about 6 months or so, or had been on Earth in front of galactic cosmic ray simulators. But those simulators give a large dose of radiation in a small amount of time to simulate the total dose you would get over a 2.5 year or 1.5 year period. So it's not the same kind of setup, because we don't have the ability to leave animals or people, for ethical reasons, sitting in front of radiation simulators for years on end. So how exactly this will translate into real world, we won't know until we do a bit more research.
Can we protect these astronauts in any way by, I don't know, setting up the ship so that it blocks some of the radiation, or possibly giving them some kind of medication so that their kidneys are protected from whatever happens when this radiation hits them?
Yeah, so there's two approaches. There's one been looked at for a very long time, which is active shielding. So at the moment, we use passive shielding on the ship, so just the thickness of the hull of the spacecraft. The other strategies we're looking at from the clinical and biological side is pharmacological interventions, so drugs or therapies. So there are people looking at giving drugs to scavenge oxidative stress and reactive species, so using antioxidants, using stuff that would try and save the mitochondria from damage, or people are looking at inhibiting certain genes that are being expressed that can cause damage. So these are inhibitors of something called microRNAs. And so they're all being investigated as countermeasures.
What is your favorite solution to all this? Because I want to see human beings on Mars in my lifetime. I'm excited for that. And it sounds like that they are going to be mutilated along the way with a trillion little paper cuts of radiation going ripping through their bodies, and also on the way back. What is the best way to ensure the safety of the astronauts?
Well, I don't think... I think you may still see people there. Remember, there's 8 billion people on the planet. You only need a few who are willing to take the risk. You know, places like Australia, New Zealand, and the Polynesian Islands wouldn't be populated unless people pointed in one direction beyond the horizon and said, let's go this way and hope there's land. I don't think it's a far stretch to find a few people who are willing to go to Mars knowing it might be a one-way trip.
Keith, how did you get involved in this research? Were you always a kidney?
Yeah.
A kidney guy?
Or a spaceman?
Space cadet. Which is what one was it? Have been calling me. No, I have been passionate about kind of kidney, blood vessel, blood pressure type stuff for a long time. And that's what I mostly do as my kind of day job, in special clinics dealing with rare diseases that affect blood pressure and salt balance. But space I've always been interested in. It's a bit sci-fi. Anything to do with space and the future I've always been fascinated by. And I saw an opportunity when I found out that NASA had a biospecimen sharing program. So this is where any scientist in the world can apply for samples that have been sent up to the space station over the past few decades at the archive in California. The truth about how we got involved was two bottles of wine on a Friday during the summer of 22 with myself and my colleague Stephen Walsh, when we sent a tipsy email to NASA saying, can we have some kidneys? And it all kind of stemmed from there.
Based on what you know, Keith, would you go to Mars if you were given the chance, all expenses paid?
No. I think it's been one thing we've been talking amongst ourselves is that I don't think I would go up to, personally, I don't think I'd go up to space for more than maybe a week or so. It just seems like the changes are a bit too dramatic, especially in a trip to Mars. So I would gladly pass up that opportunity and stay in a planet that we evolved just to live on.
And that was Keith Siu talking to us from, well, he was in Ghent, Belgium. And that was just kind of circumstantial. Mm-hmm. But he's actually from the University College London.
Yeah, he just arrived in Ghent.
Mm-hmm. Having a nice time in Belgium.
Yeah.
And yeah, probably, and he would like to stay there. He would prefer Belgium to Mars.
Mars.
Would you go?
No. No.
Why not? No, I mean, not to Ghent, but to Mars.
I'm kind of claustrophobic. The trip itself, regardless of the galactic radiation that I would be exposed to, I just wouldn't want to sit in the same room for that long.
Yeah.
I mean, that's enough for me.
Nine months.
I'm not interested enough in Mars.
9 months on a cruise ship, except it's not a cruise ship. It's very Spartan and people are closer and you're feeling physically strange most of the time. And then Mars itself, I've always thought if you're really committed to the idea of going to Mars, maybe go to a similar landscape right here on Earth. I don't know. Is the Grand Canyon somewhat similar? And spend a week there and see how you feel. But yeah, I'm with him. I'm with you. I wouldn't want to make that trip either. Part of that is, I've got kids. I've got a family. That would be kind of a selfish act.
Yes. Yeah. And I also have diabetes, which puts me at huge risk for kidney failure.
That's true.
So I wouldn't want to double it up on
sure
my poor kidneys. You know?
I think, on the candidate list, you might not make it anyhow. And that's good. That's good. One interesting fact that you wouldn't have heard in the interview is that when they take a look at people who have come down from space, and right now there's a Russian cosmonaut in space who has set the record for the longest total space flight. He's been up there for over 1,000 days. By the time he comes down, it'll be 1,100. Mm. Male bodies fare worse in space, in microgravity, than female bodies. And we were asking him about it. We were asking Keith, why is that?
He knew the answer to everything, but he straight up did not know.
And he said, we don't know.
We don't know.
And so an appeal to all researchers out there, this is a very open field of research. And I would love to know why that's the case. That's super interesting.
Yeah.
Any other questions, any comments? Would you go to Mars?
Yeah.
Why or why not? Tell us. SU at DW.com.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for Minds.